This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, powered by the Family Research Council, your embassy of faith, family, and freedom in the heart of our nation's capital. Now, here's your host, FRC President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this Wednesday edition of Washington Watch. So glad to have you with us. All right, the U.S. has some 700,000 illegal immigrants brought here as children illegally by their parents. Now, President Barack Obama, you might remember this, unilaterally allowed them to stay. Congress didn't address it. He did it on his own. He allowed them to stay under his program of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA. Well, after decades of inaction, Republicans are trying to move forward with comprehensive immigration reform that includes addressing DACA. Congressman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia will be here with the details of what could be a major breakthrough in the decades-old debate over controlling illegal immigration. And increasingly, major corporations have been inserting themselves into non-related public policy issues. A recent example, Delta Airlines eliminated their discounts for NRA members in response to the Florida high school shooting. Well, finally, lawmakers are beginning to push back. Georgia lawmakers removed a tax exemption for jet fuel that could cost Delta Airlines millions of dollars. The move essentially sends a message to Delta Airlines to fly the planes and leave the policies to us. We'll talk with Georgia Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle about that message to Delta. Also, record turnout in yesterday's primaries in the Lone Star State. Question is the Texas turnout, is it an indicator for the 2018 midterms? We'll talk with pollster and researcher Scott Rasmussen about that. And finally, the Family Research Council has released a new report finding that the Southern Poverty Law Center is ignoring rising left-wing anti-Semitism on college campuses here in the United States. Rabbi Jonathan Hausman will join us to talk about that, as will our own Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow for Regulatory Affairs. So, as you can tell, a lot of ground to cover today on this edition of Washington Watch. And if you happen to miss anything, it'll all be archived later at the website, TonyPerkins.com. And again, if you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me at T. Perkins. Okay. In January of this year, Congressman Bob Goodlatte joined two other lawmakers introducing immigration legislation entitled Securing America's Future Act, H.R. 4760. Now, the bill includes interior enforcement, border security, an end to chain migration, and also fixes the broken DACA program. With us now is Congressman Bob Goodlatte. He represents the 6th Congressional District of Virginia, and he is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which will handle this matter. Chairman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it is great to be back with you and your listeners.
Now, Congressman, as best as I can tell looking at this legislation, it appears that this delivers on what the American people want and what President Trump has requested. That's my take on it, but am I missing anything?
No, I think this is something that has widespread appeal. As people learn about it, they are very pleased to see that we are doing what the president has asked, and that is address the DACA situation for these recipients brought here illegally, usually by their parents, a number of years ago. But at the same time, we are also doing what the president has called for and Speaker of the House has called for, and that is to prevent this problem of flouting our immigration laws from continuing into the future. Because while we're a nation of immigrants, we are also a nation of laws, and respect for the rule of law has been lost in this entire debate. So this bill, as you described it, addresses the president's four pillars of a permanent solution for the DACA recipients, but not a special pathway to citizenship. They qualify under existing laws, that's fine, but they'll be able to permanently remain here, work here, travel, own a business, so on, but they cannot have a special pathway to citizenship that's set up just for them. If, however, they can qualify based upon existing laws that other people have lawfully become citizens of the United States, they will be able to take advantage of that as well. In addition, we will also close the loopholes secure the border. And, you know, when people come across the border, a lot of times they're not trying to evade the Border Patrol. They turn themselves right in and then say, I want political asylum, or I'm an unaccompanied minor. I want you to release me into the interior of the country. And under the Obama administration, that was done. Now the Trump administration doesn't want to do that, but they've found a number of loopholes in the law that we close in this bill. We eliminate the visa lottery, a crazy program that gives 55,000 green cards away every year, not based upon job skills that are needed in the country, not based on family, but based on pure luck. It has security risks, and it's simply unfair to people who are trying to come here and on long waiting lists to follow the law and come here legally. Finally, extended family immigration. And we're not talking about your immediate family, your spouse, your minor children. We always believe that's an important principle, that Americans should welcome an immigrant and they should be able to bring their immediate family with them. But extended family has resulted in people being able to bring their parents, their brothers and sisters, their adult married children. And then when those people bring people in, pretty soon you're talking about cousins and uncles and so on. So that's the chain that we're talking about. It doesn't serve the interests of the United States as much as a merit-based system like they have in the United Kingdom and Canada and Australia, where 70% of the immigrant visas are given based upon job skills, job offers, education. In the United States, it's less than 10% that goes on that basis. We're trying to change that.
Chairman Goodlatte, you've been here a little bit longer than I have. I've been here in Washington for 15 years, and this has been an issue ever since I arrived. And it sounds as if we have a bill that puts us at the threshold of actually addressing this issue of illegal immigration, allowing us to get a handle on it, regulate it so that we can— as people come in, they come in and they become a part of the American family, and we can assimilate them into our system.
It does very much do that. And I think that's what the spirit of immigration has always been about in our country, and we've kind of lost that over time. And this is trying to get us back to respect for the rule of law, understand that immigration is an important part of our nation's past, and it will remain an essential piece of our future. But it's also a two-way street. We want to have people come to the United States who are going to benefit our country, and our country will benefit people who want to come here. It's a two-way street. Right now, it's very much designed toward, well, I want to come there, but when I get there, I don't know that I want to give. It's I want to receive.
Right. I mean, and it's not— – I mean, to put this in a more personal sense, you know, you have your home— – And you invite people to come into your home, but I mean, you have you determine who comes in. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a country determining who comes in. You're not going to invite somebody into your house; it's going to do you harm.
Every
and that's
other
a part
country
of the,
on the face of the earth does it. Absolutely,
that's right.
Right.
And we used to do it that way. We used to do it that way. We had an immigration system that worked for America, and I think that's what this president is pushing for: America first. I want to ask you one question about this, because I've already heard this from some who have taken shots at the bill, that this the 700,000 illegal immigrants, these children who not all of them are still children, they're of age now, but they
right.
were brought here as children illegally by their parents. This tries to address that, I think, in a very realistic way, but it does not grant amnesty, which some claim.
Well, that's correct. What this bill says is that you will be allowed to remain in the country as they have, and you'll have a legal status, but you will not have a special pathway to citizenship. You can, like any other person who wants to immigrate to the United States and do so legally, you can earn that opportunity by taking advantage of our existing laws. But we're not going to create anything special that says, because your parents brought you here illegally at an early age, we're going to take all of these things for you in a special way that we would not do for someone whose parents brought their children here legally. And those children mm-hmm. may want to find a way to stay here. We don't say, well, because your parents brought you here legally, we're going to let you stay here forever and become citizens. What we say is, if you fit into one of the categories that our law provides for, you can adjust for that. We say the same thing now to these DACA recipients. We think that's fair, and it's not amnesty by my standard of amnesty. Now, some people call that
amnesty anyway. But they have to get in line, and they don't get to the head of the line. They have to get in line like everybody else to get on the path of citizenship. Correct?
Right, and they have to qualify in one of the categories that exists. So there will be no special one created that just they can have.
So the point is we don't kick them out of the country because they
absolutely
came,
not.
They were granted this status, and in keeping faith with what, even though we disagree with what was done, we're not going to kick them out of the country, but there's no special provisions for them. They have to be treated like everybody else who wants to come and be a part of America.
That's correct. And I think that's fair, too, and I think that appeals to the fairness that Americans are known for.
Well, Chairman Goodlatte, let's talk about the status of this bill. Where does it stand? What are the holdups? I've talked to some in leadership. I was talking with the majority whip this morning about this bill. And there seems to be even some fragmentation among the ranks of Republicans.
Yes. Well, this is a bill, because we have this balanced approach of both addressing DACA but also addressing enforcement, that has unfortunately not attracted support from Democrats who want simply to have amnesty for DACA recipients and take no responsibility for making sure that this problem doesn't continue, because every day there's still an opportunity for people to bring their children into this country unlawfully and then in the future make the same kind of claim. And we want that to stop. So what we've had to do is look for support amongst the 241 Republicans in the House, and that support is building steadily and rapidly. And as soon as we get to the point where we have enough votes of Republicans and any Democrats that will join us, the leadership will bring this bill to the floor for vote. And I think it will pass the House, but we're still working to make sure that that happens.
Do you think we'll get this before the midterm elections?
Oh, definitely. This is something that we need to do in the next several weeks.
All right. So how can folks that are concerned about this, want to see it addressed, how can they help move this legislation forward?
They can be a tremendous help by letting their legislator, their member of Congress, know that they support the Securing America's Future Act. That's what it's called, Securing America's Future. By the way, it's not just my bill, but Chairman Mike McCaul, chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, wrote this with me. Representative Raul Labrador, who's chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee at Judiciary, wrote this with us. And Representative Martha McSally of Arizona, who's the chairman of the Border Security Subcommittee at the Homeland Security Committee, participated as well. So it's got broad-based support, and we just are working on getting additional support. Let your legislator know you want them to support this. That'd be a big help.
All right. Well, we'll certainly put that word out. Chairman Bob Goodlatte, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tony.
All right. Congressman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia. The Capitol switchboard number to call your member of Congress, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. I'll talk more about this later, hopefully, because I think it's time to address this in a, and I think in a reasonable manner, and I do think this bill gets as close as I've seen before. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, That's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As Senior Director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. All right, as I told you yesterday, we were broadcasting actually from Atlanta, Georgia, as I was making my way back. And I flew out of Atlanta, which is a frequent occasion, or frequently done. But you may recall, we've talked about this before, you may recall back in 2014, Delta Airlines was one of the first corporations to speak out against Georgia's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Well, Delta has again weighed in on constitutional issues. This time it was the Second Amendment. On the heels of the February 14th Florida school shooting, the Atlanta-based Delta Airlines discontinued offering discounted travel to NRA members to send a message. Well, Georgia lawmakers, in my opinion, rightfully sent a message to them, approving a bill that eliminated a nearly $50 million tax break on jet fuel sales tax that primarily benefited Delta Airlines. I mean, lawmakers essentially told Delta to fly the planes and leave the policies to us. Joining me now is the Georgia Lieutenant Governor, Casey Cagle. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, great to be with you. Sorry I missed you on your visit to Atlanta. I'd love to have a chance to catch up with you, but it's good to be with you today on your program.
Well, it seems like I go through Atlanta quite often, so maybe one of these times we can catch up. Although I will say that, you know, after I saw this, once again, corporate activism on behalf of Delta, I sent them a message and have tried to shift as much as I can to some other airlines. But I think we've seen this over and over, and I think you've spoken out on this before, about these major corporations weighing into public policy, that there's a price to be paid for that, in my view.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Tony. And I think there's several lessons to be learned through this. Delta made a huge mistake weighing in to the boycott and the timing by which it took place. First of all, this negotiation that Delta did with the NRA was for their convention. So businesses do this all the time. They sell out seats on planes. They sell out hotel rooms, all of those things. And this was done. And then they reversed course because of what took place in Florida, as if they were sending a message that to all law-abiding gun owners that this is not acceptable. And I view this kind of as a viewpoint discrimination, and I do not find it to be acceptable. And so they did have, as you articulated, a $50 million tax, actually a tax exemption on jet fuel. Their portion was smaller than that, that was going through the legislature. And I sent a tweet out that was very clear that either Delta would reinstate that discount that had been issued, or that I would kill their legislation, and that's exactly what we did. And I think we made the right decision. I think there's two courses there. One is a course of did Delta really need an exemption on jet fuel? And many felt that they didn't, but when they weighed in on the boycott, that was really the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, Governor Cagle, I, for one, as a former lawmaker, a legislator, I applaud the action, because I think it's past time for lawmakers to send a message to these corporate activists who want to use their profits to weigh in on policy unrelated to their business. Now, I completely understand they have a right to lobby, and I had a top rating from the business community, and I'm all about low regulation, low taxes to promote economic growth. But they're increasingly weighing in on non-related issues, and I for one, am happy to see lawmakers finally pushing back.
Well, Tony, when we as conservatives stand together and we fight, we always win, and that's the beauty. If we can get more conservatives to lock arms to arm and really go about a very, very clear message when there is this overreach against the core values and principles that we hold dear, we will win. But sadly enough, oftentimes, people want to argue, about how far to the right you can be or how far to the left you can be instead of moving and advancing the ball. And so we won on this issue, and we're going to continue to win, obviously, for the citizens of our state and for the values that we hold dear. And the liberal media, along with the liberals across the country, have attacked me like you wouldn't believe, along with my family. And they've obviously
I would believe it. I would believe it.
You understand how that is. But the issue here for me is that they want to make this an issue about just Delta and that business has the ability to do whatever they choose to do. But liberals constantly on their side of the aisle pressure big corporations to make decisions like this. And that's the reason we have to fight back. That's the reason we have to push back, and we can constantly get kicked, and yet we do nothing about it. And so as you, I am very much a free enterprise individual. I believe in capitalism, but on the same token, why would any business divide their customer base in half? And that's basically what they've done. And that's the kind of mistakes that ultimately will come back to where shareholders will say, we've had enough of this. And I think we need to get back into the business of standing up and being willing to have the courage to do it. And, it's just kind of like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You can bow or you can stand, and I'm choosing to stand.
Well, I applaud you and stand with you. I find it refreshing. Finally, standing, we see people standing up against big corporations that are running roughshod over the American people because, as you said, they're being squeezed by activists, and they won't stand up to these left-wing activists, and so they put lawmakers in untenable situations. And I'm glad you called them out for it, and I applaud you, Governor.
Well,
so thanks so much.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
And I'll holler at you next time I'm coming through Atlanta.
Please do. I look forward to visiting with you soon.
All right. Georgia Lieutenant Governor Cagle. And anyway, good news story. Good news story. In fact, I would encourage you to go to TonyPerkins.com. Follow the links over and send him a message. When these guys take the right stands, it's so important that we applaud them. All right? This is one of those opportunities. All right, when we come back, We're going to be looking at the election results from Texas. Anything in the tea leaves of what may be to come in the fall? We're going to look at that when we come back. Don't go away.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us this afternoon. All right, yesterday, Texas became the first state to officially hold its primaries for the 2008 midterms. Now, some say that the road to a Democratic majority in Congress goes through Texas. Well, I mean, the odds are against the Republicans historically. I mean, since the Civil War, the president's party, the president in power, has lost on average 32 seats in the midterm election in the House and I think roughly around two in the Senate. The question is, will that trend continue? And what can we tell from yesterday's outcome in Texas? Joining us now, one of my favorite pollsters and analysts, Scott Rasmussen. Scott, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's great to be with you. And, you know, there are so many ways people talk about these midterms and the numbers and the averages. I want to convey a sense that the historical track record is not as clear-cut as people make it seem. In the last 10 midterm elections, the party out of power has gained 25 seats or more four times out of 10. The number 25 is significant because if the Democrats win 25 seats, pick up 25 seats, they will win control. So in recent history, it's pretty much a toss-up, and I think that's a good way to look at it. This thing is far from settled.
So what do we know after yesterday's turnout in Texas? Are any early signs there of voter engagement?
At the risk of, we all overanalyze these first things because they come first. We certainly know that Democrats are enthusiastic. They did show up in larger numbers than previously to vote. They did have candidates active in all kinds of races. Probably not enthusiastic enough to represent a threat to Ted Cruz in the U.S. Senate. In fact, among primary, he picked up twice as many primary votes as O'Rourke, his new competitor. But there are signs that enthusiasm is real, and nationally, it's going to create a challenge for Republicans. I think the other news that comes out of the primary yesterday that is perhaps good news for Republicans is that there is a real civil war going on in the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the more establishment Democrats. And in the early rounds yesterday, the first skirmishes of that battle, the progressives came out ahead. A great example was in Texas 7. Laura Moser is a progressive candidate who the National Party did not want to get the nomination. She is now in a runoff, pretty much in a clear repudiation of the National Democrats' efforts. That becomes significant because it's a very competitive district. Democrats think it's a district they could win. If they nominate progressives in districts like that, the Republicans have a much better chance of hanging on.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more, I think, the political polarization where the liberals get more liberal and the conservatives get more conservative. The latter I'm not concerned about. The former I am. What's important when you look at, number one, we're going to have, by the time we get to the fall elections, we're probably going to have 40 retirements of Republicans in the House.
Right.
So, and we've got a number of seats that are kind of in marginal districts where these trends have more of an impact. So this could be a very, very competitive midterm.
Yes. There are right now, we estimate, about 45 competitive districts in the country. And the overwhelming majority of those are held by Republicans. So there are opportunities for Democrats. And as I mentioned earlier, the Democratic enthusiasm to resist and oppose this president and his policies is very real. One group that I think is worth thinking about and trying to figure out how to reach them and what they're going to do are a group of people that I call reluctant Trump supporters or reluctant Trump voters. It's been a long time since election 2016, but on that day, 10% of all voters, 1 out of every 10 voters who went to the polls, voted for Donald Trump despite believing that he was unqualified to be president, which is both a commentary on him but also on his opponent. They thought he was unqualified but still the lesser of two evils. These are people who today disapprove of the president. They're not happy he's there. They don't like a lot of the way he carries himself. But they are happy Neil Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court and that regulatory efforts are being slowed and that the tax cuts went into effect. Will these people show up and support candidates who are aligning themselves with President Trump? If they don't, if they stay home, it could be a very long night for the Republicans.
30 seconds, we're up against a break. What would it take to get them there? What's required to motivate them?
The fact that the Democratic candidates would be the fact that the Republican candidate is the lesser of two evils. If the Democrats nominate very progressive candidates, that would help Republican turnout. If the Republicans can focus on policy accomplishments, tax cuts, deregulation, and tie it into the growing economy, that would get them to the polls. But they are going to be the decisive, really swing group in this election.
Well, that's going to be a hard needle to thread. Scott Rasmussen, as always, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, Scott Rasmussen. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. He's got a newsletter and lots of information out there. He's always got good insight into elections. All right, coming up next, FRC has released a new report. It finds that the Southern Poverty Law Center is ignoring anti-Semitic hate crimes, activities on college campuses. We'll talk about it when we come back with Rabbi Jonathan Hausman. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
I'm Tony Perkins, and you are listening to Washington Watch, and we are thrilled with that fact. The website, TonyPerkins.com, if you are on Twitter, at T. Perkins. All right. Okay, a new report shows that the Southern Poverty Law Center, a liberal anti-Christian group that claims to track hate groups, is ignoring, listen to this, rising left-wing anti-Semitism on college campuses. Surprise, surprise. With us now is Rabbi Jonathan Hausman, who is from Massachusetts, and he is the rabbi at Agava Torah Congregation. I think I got that close. At least I'm close. Rabbi, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hello, Mr. Perkins. How are you today?
I'm doing quite well. As you can tell, my Hebrew is not all that great.
Well, that's okay. My Latin isn't that great, so I think we're all right.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you surprised by the fact that the Southern Poverty Law Center is ignoring this? Really, it's troubling when you look at the reports of the anti-Semitic activity on college campuses in the United States. It's alarming to me. I would have to imagine that it's alarming to you, but my question is it surprising to you that the Southern Poverty Law Center is ignoring it?
Listen, I'll be honest with you. I'm not surprised by anything that comes out from the Southern Poverty Law Center where it ignores hatred from and bigotry from you know, its most common sources right now. And, you know, if you take a look at what's happening now, most of what's emanating with regard to anti-Jewish feelings and anti-Semitic acts happen to be from the left. But the, you know, as we all know, the Southern Poverty Law Center seems to have lost its moorings. You know, I always found it very interesting when Senator Jeff Sessions was nominated to be Attorney General of the United States. You know, he was being absolutely crucified. You should pardon the use of the word, but he was crucified as a racist and a bigot. And, you know, it was information back in the 80s that Jeff Sessions used, information that was gleaned and compiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center that helped shut the Klan down in Alabama completely. And you take a look at where they are now, completely ignoring boycott, divest, and sanction activities on college campuses, completely ignoring Students for Justice in Palestine and their activities on campus, completely ignoring the relationships that groups like J Street have with some of the most nefarious people on campus. And you know, you talk to somebody like me, I have to be honest with you. I have a daughter that just graduated college this past May, and you know, we take her off campus, and she turned to me and she said, you know, Dad, thank God I'm leaving the campus right now because of things that were happening on her campus. And I'm not going to give the name of the campus, but things were happening. You have, you know, and it's not just vis-a-vis students where you have these activities, these actions taking places, but against faculty members as well. I've hosted in the past a speakers forum, a free speech forum out of my synagogue. And years ago, I had, 2 years ago, I think it was, I had a panel that I put together comprised of professors who are all associated with Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. And we listened to Professor Gabe Grom and Professor Jonathan Edelman and Professor Alexander Jaffe speak about what's happening amongst the professoriate on campus. You know, it's just as bad with regard to what's happening to pro-Israel professors, pro-Jewish professors. Professor Andrew Pessin at Conn College in New London, Connecticut, hounded off campus. And if you've ever met Professor Pessin, he's the most gentle guy you'd ever want to meet, but hounded off campus by the Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at Conn College. My mother, may she rest in peace, used to say that Jewish history runs in 70-year cycles. And yes. You know, here we are. 70-plus years after World War II and the Holocaust, and, you know, we see this recrudescence of anti-Semitism in the academy again, and Germany, this is where it started. I shouldn't say where it started, but certainly where it took its greatest root, you know?
And you go to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, and you walk through the Holocaust Museum there, and you see the historical displays of what took place in the Jewish businesses in Germany where they were marked, and then you see the divestment push, the boycott that is being pushed. It's the same thing, just a different name.
Exactly the same thing. I agree 100%. 100%. And you know, not for nothing, Natan Sharansky, that great fighter for Jewish liberty, and not just Jewish liberty and freedom, but liberty and freedom throughout the Judeo-Christian world. You know, he stated some 14 years ago or so, I think it was, that, you know, there's a test with regard to all of this stuff. If you want to know if the positions that somebody holds happens to be anti-Semitic, you use his formula was the 3 Ds. I don't know if you've ever heard it. Demonization, delegitimization, and double standards. You know, and in the world today, Israel has taken the place of the Jew. But you're talking about the same kinds of acts, you know,
yes,
where Jews, the fundamental right to exist for Jews is this denied, you know, alone amongst all the people of the world. This is anti-Semitism.
It's interesting, Rabbi Hausman, it's interesting as I have delved deeper into the issue with Israel and the global anti-Semitic movement, that there are strong, strong ties between the way evangelicals are treated by the left and Jews are treated by the left.
Particularly
tactics.
Today, you see the what was a statistic I read, a number I read yesterday, I think it was by Raymond Ibrahim, you know, that there are 210 million Christians today who are in physical in existential danger, losing their lives, losing their lives for no other reason but they're Christians.
And, well, to your point of the demonization.
Pardon me?
Well, to your point of how they want to demonize and delegitimize, that's exactly what the Southern Poverty Law Center is doing, not only with evangelicals in this country.
Completely ignoring this, completely. So, you know, it's not just, it seems to me, you know, maybe I'm oversimplifying this. You know, my father, may he rest in peace, used to say, you know, kid, when somebody tells you, listen, this issue is really complicated, he used to say, listen, things are not really that complicated. You know, you can cut right through the knot very simply. And it just seems to me that this is all an assault on the foundations, on the moral and ethical foundations of Western civilization. You can call it Western civilization. You can call it the Judeo-Christian civilization, whatever you want to call it. But if you can unhinge those moorings, then you can lead to the downfall of the West as we know it.
And which then gives the rise to its replacement or to totalitarian government. And for those that are, you know, fans of big oppressive government, that's the way you do it.
This is exactly the way you do it. I mean, this is what happened in Germany. This is what the Soviet Union did. If you want to take a look at modern manifestations of this, look at Cuba, look at Venezuela, you know?
Let me ask you this, Rabbi, before I let you go, because I just think it's a very interesting point that you brought up earlier about this is driven by the left, the anti-Semitic activities on college campuses. This is the left. And I've always struggled with this, why so many Jewish people in America are attracted to the liberal policies of the Democratic Party and to the left, when in fact we see those entities, those individuals turning on the Jewish community.
Well, yeah, listen, it's not just young Jews. It's young people across the board. I visited my daughter's campus. This was a couple of years ago. I went to pick her up for spring break, and I arrived at campus early. I just asked my kid, you mind if I come to class with you? No, not a problem. I said, listen, I promise I'll sit in the back. I won't say a word. And one of her classes in digital media, you should have heard the discussions about how Bernie Sanders was not really a socialist and how socialism and communism really aren't that bad. And, you know, from our generation, you turn around and you say, wait a minute, you know, how many millions of people did Stalin kill in the name of perfecting society?
Right.
How many people did Pol Pot kill in the name of perfecting society? Mao Zedong, one of the greatest mass murderers of all time. And you know, our educational system has been dummied down to such an extent that we have a young generation. They just don't understand the whoop and wharf, the tide, the eddies and tides of history and how this all works together.
Dangerous.
Yeah, you know, here in Massachusetts, we got standardized testing, you know, in several grades. So you teach to the test, and it's all Common Core driven. And, you know, what ends up happening? You have a high school kid who comes home and says, you know, that Truman's decision to drop the bomb in World War II was immoral. And not setting this up as the Hegelian dialectic, you know, we'll argue, was it moral or immoral? No, just come on, it's immoral. You know, you sit and you scratch your head. By the way, this is a true story. My kid came home with this. And, you know, I had to tell her about her grandfather, my father, who fought in the Pacific for 4 years, highly medaled and whatnot. He said, listen, I don't know what your teacher's telling you, but this is what it was.
And that's,
it really does go across the board. And you know, just to finish with one thought, this concept of intersectionality, I think, plays a big role in all this stuff, where if you have an oppressed people here, name one. The African American community historically in the United States, and you have the Palestinians over there. Well, you know, these two communities, because you're talking about communities, peoples of color, they have something in common when they may not have anything in common. So, because the Palestinians have issues with Jews, therefore the Black Lives Matter people now have issues with Jews as well.
Which is a dangerous way to look at the world.
Oh, without question.
Rabbi Jonathan Hausman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Perkins. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Rabbi Jonathan Hausman, to find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. All right, before we depart here this afternoon, I want to bring in Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow for Regulatory Affairs here at the Family Research Council. He's familiar with the report that I was talking with the rabbi about, just released, about this rise in anti-Semitic activity on college campuses across the nation. And as we pointed out, the Southern Poverty Law Center, crickets, nothing, saying nothing about it. And they're supposed to be, this great organization that tracks hate groups. Well, seems like they're a little selective in what they track. Chris Gasek, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Good to see you again.
All right, so give us a summary here. We just got a few minutes. Sure. Give us a summary of what this report shows.
Well, I think the you summarized it pretty well and very ably, and so did the rabbi, which is very moving to hear him talk about these phenomena from his perspective, right? But I think the main thing is that the first sort of point that Christians have to realize, and Christians who care about, as we all should, about Israel and Jewish people, the level of anti-Semitism on college campuses is mind-bogglingly just shocking. It's hard to convey to people. One of the things that's so fascinating is when you see things like the number of very good Jewish groups that are tracking this, and then you start to read like reports of students who are sort of filtering in, what happened to you at the campus and stuff like that, your campus, especially in places like the University of California system and other major schools. It's just, bordering on violence very often, just people, not wearing clothes that they would wear, their religious, garb or jewelry. And I think that's sort of a predicate to the sort of the main story, which is that, part A is a level of anti-Semitism that people of our age, growing out of World War II and sort of watching, the whole history like the rabbi was talking about, we could never have imagined this. But then, right, you have this combined with, sort of the presence of groups that are just responsible for this. 180 chapters for SJP across America, and there's no mention of this, right? So you just can't randomly miss all that, right?
Right. All right, Chris, folks can find the report at tonyperkins.com. Folks, out of time. We're going to cover this some more. But until next time, I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, "When you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, keep standing."
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. Again, that's 1-866-372-7234. 372-7234.